Everybody, welcome to another thrilling episode of Data Exposed. I'm your host, Scott Klein, and back again in the studio is Maxim. Maxim, how are you?
Hi, Scott. Yeah, nice.
Good. So, not your fourth time here, but we're back to kind of, I think, the wrap up the series on Spark performance tuning.
Yeah, that's a final episode, yes.
Yep. So we'll have to find more episodes for you to, topics for you to come talk about.
Oh, it's always I'm sure there will be plenty.
Yeah. We talked about one after our show last week. We talked about one about doing...
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, so we won't give it away. It'll be a surprise. So. Luckily, he remembers what we talked about. But anyway, you're here to talk about number four, performance tuning.
Just to remind you, the previous episodes were about various performance tuning techniques.
Yep.
And this episode is advanced techniques. So finally, we are coming to some kind of a more complicated techniques.
Okay, good. Yeah, so we just published number two today.
Oh, nice. Yep. That's great.
So... and then number three will go out probably next week. So we're going to record number four. So what do you got for us? So last week, recap. We talked about some of the more of the advanced. Like in number two, we talked about data sets and RDDs and partitioning and caching and things like that, right? And number three, what did we talk about there?
It was mostly about joins and all of the kind of standard things that you need to do with your big data query pipeline to make it efficient.
Perfect. So what do you got for us today for number four?
Well, for number four, we have a couple of advanced techniques.
Okay.
And so, they're advanced, so we'll wait until we talk about them.
That's right. There's advanced, and then there's advanced techniques.
Oh, yeah. We are going deeper and deeper, yes.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
And hopefully by the end, we'll do a little bit of a recap of what we talked about and have kind of a more pointers and references for folks who want to kind of go in even deeper than that.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay, sweet.
So advanced techniques. So what do we got? So let's start with kind of remembering that the technique that we already discussed, the partitioning.
Yep.
So it's a fairly simple technique. It just puts data into these folders, and then it enables the Spark kind of query optimizer to skip all of the other folders if the folder that contains the data can be identified that the only one that needs to be looked at.
Okay. Yep.
So it's a fairly simple technique, and as such, it has some limitations.
Okay.
And the primary limitation with it is that every folder needs to correspond to a single value of your chosen partitioning column.
Yeah.
In this example, we are partitioning by year, so every year will correspond to some value, like 2005 or 2006.
Okay. Yep.
So it works great if you have like small number of small number of these values, but there are many situations where you have like thousands or even millions of values in this folder.
You might want to partition on,
So, and you might want to partition on them. Like, for example, if you say that, product ID. Product ID may be, imagine that you have like a catalog of millions of products.
Right.
So now you're going to have like this millions of folders. And unfortunate reality is that Hadoop, as kind of this end-to-end system, is not really optimized for dealing with millions of files.
Okay.
So if you're switching to this kind of threshold, if you're like going beyond partitioning limits, you're talking about having like millions of partitions. And at that point, your operations start to be kind of bottlenecked by the actual file system itself. Like you need to first, like even if you just create this partition table, you need to first create this folder, then put this little file into this folder, then create this another one and do it millions of times.
Yep.
And the system is not really doing it well because it is bottlenecked by this latency of this individual metadata operations.
Yep. Okay.
So you're talking about, if you're doing like 100,000s of partitions, you'll be fine. Like you can create, for example, this partition table in minutes.
Yeah.
But if you're switching to millions, suddenly you're talking about, just creating it will take me days. So it becomes completely non-practical. So that's a limit of partitioning. So bucketing scheme is a new feature in Spark that allows you to kind of address this limitation. As you can see, probably infer from this, my awesome pictures. Maybe, let's test you. Like, can you infer how bucketing works? Like this 9, 17, 20 product ID in a single Parquet file. Sorry for putting you on the spot. So there's a product ID that is equal 9. There's another product ID that is equal 17. And they're together in the same file.
Yeah, right. Yes. But is there a logic to how they're bucketed? So I was looking for a pattern.
There is no logic. So, but you got it. So basically, these different IDs are now bucketized into a single file. Like if in partitioning we had a single value corresponding to a single folder, now we are saying, hey, we can put multiple of these values into a single file. And that allows you to limit the number of buckets that you can have.
Okay.
And regarding the logic, no, there is no logic.
Okay.
It's just this decision of which ID or which product will go into which bucket is done based on the hashing function, which means, hey, it will hash the value. It will produce basically a random integer based on the how many total buckets you wanted to have.
I see.
And it will go somewhere. But the nice property of hashing, it will do this in a somewhat even manner. So all of your product IDs will be evenly spread across this given number of buckets.
Okay, so that from a bucketing standpoint, you know, when I'm adding something, that makes sense. But how does it know when I go query, does it have to go across all the buckets to find product ID 17, for example, or?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the nice properties of bucketed tables is that it does remember how it did these operations, like how it bucketed the table.
So is it based on the hash then?
Yeah, so it remembers the hash function. So it'll say that, hey, if I need to like retrieve a product ID number 5, it will still be able to do the same filtering operation and it will read the bucket.
So it doesn't have to go to every one. It goes, I know I put a product ID 5 here, go to here.
Yeah. So selectivity is still not as good as with partitioning because now it will need to scan both product IDs with 12 and 68, which it doesn't really need.
Yep.
And there are some other techniques that it can apply to.
Millions. I just go to the one I want to, and
but at least you go into the one. So that's kind of a nice property of bucketing table.
Yeah.
But the primary benefit of it is actually comes from the fact that it kind of remembers how it did the bucketing.
Right.
You can say like, hey, the table kind of gets a little bit of self-awareness. Like it, the system as an end-to-end thing kind of becomes more kind of reflective. It remembers the decisions that it made. It remembers how the data is structured.
All right. Yep,
and this is the primary property of bucketing, which enables kind of very nice kind of optimizations that happen in Spark down the stream.
Right.
Like now that it knows how the data is bucketed, and also it remembers actually how the data is even sorted. So if you sort data in the table, that sort key in a bucketed table will also be remembered.
Okay.
And then used in the future for all kinds of performance optimizations.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's a kind of a most powerful thing because it enables a variety of very practical kind of performance optimization techniques that were not possible before with non-bucketed tables.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. So bucketing, 2.0.
Yeah. Awesome. Just to illustrate a couple of examples, so let's take a look at that one. So one of the simple optimizations that Spark is able to do when it does aggregations, basically in a traditional aggregation, every kind of row that you aggregate needs to be placed into a, like proper aggregation bucket.
Yep.
And that is usually accomplished in a standard variant. It's usually accomplished through this network exchange. So basically you're distributing your data across nodes. Every node will do its partial job. And then shuffle operation, after the network exchange, on the other hand of the shuffle, there will be a final bucket that will collect all of the appropriate kind of keys from every kind of partially aggregated bucket or partitions of data and create the final value.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
But now that Spark knows that our table is bucketed by a specific key, if this key matches how you aggregate data, then it says, hey, your data is already bucketed exactly on the same thing that I'm going to bucket it for aggregation.
Okay.
So that means that I don't need to do network exchanges anymore. Data is already kind of in the same bucket, so I don't need to go across the bucket. So it will skip this network exchange and give you more performance.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And that all kind of lights up automatically as long as you bucketed your table with the same key or part of the key as you do your aggregations on.
Is there a way, you have to tell the table, this is a bucketed table at that point?
Okay. So when you create your table, you do like just like with partitioning, you say, hey, Now create a bucketed table, bucketed by these columns, and maybe sorted as well by those columns. And all of that metadata and data will be preserved in a persistent form. Yeah. So that's one simple example of aggregation optimization.
Sweet.
So one more kind of a nice feature of that bucketed tables, or the feature that it enables, is joining large tables.
Okay.
And that is...
We talked joins in our last episode.
Exactly.
Right, yes. But this is now how we're joining bucketed tables?
Yes, so now we are going back to these joins all over and over again. And if you remember, we talked about the sort merge joins and broadcast joins before that.
Yep.
And this is, I put them again here just to illustrate the problem.
Like,
in the previous episode, we tried to look like, hey, it's all awesome. You do this one or you do that one, and it's
everything's
great.
Cool.
And but that was not true. So if you remember, the sort merge join is like a universal join. It can join tables of any sizes.
Yep.
But it is slow because it needs to sort this data left and right side. It needs to resort everything. It takes forever.
Yeah.
It's a very heavy computational operation. Broadcast join helps with that, where it says, hey, if one of your tables is small enough, we will stop sorting the first table and we'll just send this whole like data set to each node.
Yep.
And that's how we will avoid sorting this large table.
Gotcha. Yep.
But what happens if this another table is also large?
Yeah.
Then you're like back into this slow world of sort merge joins. And if you really need to join large tables, it kind of you're now in a corner. Like
this is going to take forever.
This is going to take forever, and it does take forever. Like let's take a look at the example. I should have one. This one. So this one is an example of two large joins with a very little filter. So that's modified. That's our test query that is modified with having smaller filter or less selective filter. Okay. So you can see it tries to like process a few hundreds of billions of rows.
200 billion rows.
And because it because this right hand side table is also large enough, we cannot use broadcast join. So we are forced to use the sort merge join. And you can see here that it injects the sort operations, and it takes it takes 25 minutes to do the sort merge join. It takes the seconds. Where is this? Oh, and 25 minutes to do the sorting. So it takes a long time.
Yep.
So this sort merge join is kind of a pain.
Yeah.
So is there a better way, or we are like stuck with this thing?
Yeah.
So
bucketed
tables offers a better way, where it say, hey, if this join between these two large tables is such a critical operation, can we like massage these tables or arrange them in such a way that this join operation can be performed efficiently?
Yep.
And it helps. So basically, because the sort merge join, kind of the key operation that it performs is sorting, the idea is simple. Like, why don't we pre-sort this tables in the right way, when they're stored on the system, they already is sorted in the right way.
Okay.
And then potentially it should be very easy for us to join them. They're like if they're just already sorted, just merge them. So that's exactly what combination of our bucketing tables and Spark optimizations enables. Now that bucketed table can be pre-sorted in the right way.
When does the pre-sort happen?
When you create
the table?
Bucketed table, it's a quite like intentional operation. You need to know, like, hey, I need to join efficiently with this other table by this specific key.
Okay.
So I'm optimizing exactly for this scenario, and then I'll pre-sort my table with that key, and I'll bucket it with that same key, and then everything will be fine.
So this is going to have to be So you're going to have to do your homework to know, I need this bucketed and I need this pre-sorted. Because you may not want to do that with every table.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So I know that I'm going to be joining these two tables, so I may want to bucket and pre-sort these type of thing.
Yeah, perfect, right? Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah, and you need to first know in advance that this is even possible. Because like, hey, if you find yourself in the corner like, hey, this thing that I'm trying to accomplish, it's just so slow, there is like no way out.
Yeah.
Then if you know about this technique, then there is this is your way out.
Okay.
Then you can plan ahead that, oh, so I have this heavy operation kind of naturally yep. occurring because of the structure of my data. So I can arrange my data in such a way and get okay. it solved in a very fast manner. So let's take a look at
Can you go from a non-bucketed to bucketed, you know, table? So, when I created it, it wasn't bucketed. Can I then make it a bucketed table and be able to take advantage of that after the fact?
Well, kind of yes, but it still makes you still need to create a new table. Basically, you copy data in a new layout.
So you can't
data.
Alter table, make it bucketed.
Alter table, not in this version, but potentially.
Okay.
But it would still be kind of a computationally intensive operation. You need to basically resort all of the data. But once, and then use it all the time.
Yeah, sure. So it probably makes sense to make it another table and just copy the data over, and it'll go in sorted. Okay.
Yeah, there is no disadvantage of having table bucketed in a specific way.
Yep.
Like all of the other queries will still be possible. It's just some of the queries that you kind of bucketed your table for will become very efficient. So that's
okay. I'm going to ask a very potentially dangerous question.
Okay.
Would there ever be a case where I would want to have the same table twice, one bucketed, one not bucketed?
This is a really advanced question. So now we are like truly advanced.
Apparently, we just created a forward series number 5 show.
Actually, yes, that's potentially it. But you're right. Yes, there is like certainly there is a case when you want your table to be in different forms for different queries, especially if you have this complicated queries that really require some heavy operations like joining two large tables. And you have two use cases where you want to join by two different keys, then yes, you would need to have two tables.
And that's sort of opening up, because now you have to insert into both tables, and you might, you know, and that could open up a can of worms, or okay, you know, how many copies of this table am I going to get? Because I might have different scenarios. Right, so that can get very ugly and very messy very quickly if we're not careful. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right, we're going to stop right there.
Maybe if somebody's listening, maybe there is a place for like some startup that will build such a system.
Yeah,
we'll automate all of that complexity.
So we'll save that for episode 5. After episode 5, apparently. All right.
Okay, so let's take a look at the good way. So if it bucketed the table in the right way, then if you perform the same query, you can see that the sort operation is now skipped.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yep.
And now it takes us just a minute to read it and then a minute to join it. So now we are like from this very long times. Actually, the previous query, I stopped it even before it finished, so it's taking even more than like 40 minutes. So now we are talking about like a 2 orders of magnitude improvement.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
So really, you know, so if you're in this situation, you really need to know about how these things can be done in Spark in order to achieve like some reasonable results.
Okay, and I'm sure this is gonna take some experimenting as we're getting into some of the performance, implementing some of these techniques. I'm sure there'll be some experimenting as they go forward and say, okay, I need to do this and I don't need to do that type of scenario, right?
Perfect. That's a perfect segue to kind of our summary. Yes.
Oh.
So, yes.
And we didn't talk about this before.
So what is our summary? Yeah. So basically we talked about these things throughout this episode.
Yep.
But to summarize, basically the thing about Spark, it's very nice, kind of a robust and performant execution engine.
Yeah.
But it's still open source, and you need to take kind of a mind of kind of an exploratory mindset to some degree, because when you apply it to every situation, every data set, every set of queries, you will discover some of the things that might go in an unexpected way.
Yeah, okay.
And the best way to kind of be in control of the situation is to use this tools that allow you to monitor, hey, is are those things going according to what my expectations are?
Right.
And we have this great tools in Spark UI like SQL Graph and and timeline you. So all those tools, you need to take a look at them and working with a new set of queries and spot like, hey, what are the wrong things that are going on?
Yep.
And to illustrate kind of the type of wrong things, let's go back. Remember this nice kind of rectangles that we talked about.
Yep.
So that's one of your kind of simple
criteria.
So if you see your nice long rectangles breaking, that's one sign.
Okay.
And they can break actually in a pretty unexpected ways. Here is example of one of the ways. So here is our kind of rectangle. It's still going, doing all of these joints in place, nice. But then suddenly it's breaking, and it performs sort aggregate instead of our regular hash aggregate.
Okay.
So what's going on? So apparently when you see that, you need to actually take a closer look. Mm. And in this case, the problem was kind of very interesting. So this nice long rectangles is basically a whole stage code generation that Spark performs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty involved operation because Spark needs to be able to generate kind of very low level code that performs every operation.
Right.
And there are some limits in the code gen. So for example, in this case, the schema of the table had this column amount specified as a string type. That was just a mistake during the data import. And the limitation in Spark code generation is that it expects that, hey, if I'm aggregating something, this thing that I'm aggregating needs to be kind of a mutable types, like numbers.
It can make certain assumptions. Yeah,
so because it does some optimizations at the low level, kind of replacing values and things like that.
Right.
So there are some limitations. And string types are immutable in Spark. So when it's discussed, oh, you're trying to aggregate the stringy thing, I don't know how to do that in an efficient way, so let me fall back into this less efficient sort aggregate.
Okay, yeah.
So the fix in this case would be simple, like, hey, just cast this amount as double or some decimal type, and then everything will be back to normal. But that's an example of things can go wrong in some places. And remember our other kind of ways to check that, hey, event timeline. Always kind of take a look at that. If you see some outliers here, it's another sign that, hey, things are not going as well as they're expected to be. And there are many other kind of tools that people can use. Here is a few links kind of to a more advanced debugging techniques.
Yep.
For example, like one of the very common ways to understand what's going on is to monitor CPU usage. Like if your query is well optimized, then your CPU usage will be fairly high.
Okay.
If it drops below, then maybe something else is becoming bottleneck and you want to take a look. So in Azure HD Insight, we have this integration with nice Azure service called Operation Management Suite that you can easily enable using UI and then take a look at all of the CPU usages of your cluster and the nodes. So where do we have that thing? Here. So if you look at your cluster with all of its standard things, there is a monitoring tab where you can enable integration with operation management suite and send all of the CPU metrics and things like that into OMS workspace of your choice.
Okay. And from there you can view everything that's going on from the CPU perspective.
CPU usage across
the
nodes.
On all the nodes?
On all of the nodes of the cluster.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another more advanced tools or kind of a more low-level tools that we found also useful is if you want to kind of go deeper in terms of single node operations, and this Intel PAL tool is a great way to aggregate your CPU usage. If you want to go really down to the level of your code and see which specific function in your code is becoming a bottleneck and optimize some IO metrics as well, then Oracle Mission Control performance kind of profiling tools are really nice. So all of those tools you can use on Azure HD Insight clusters because they're kind of open architecture.
Okay.
Like you can log in into every node, install anything you want on it. It's just standard Linux. We love Linux, and do anything you want from the performance point of view.
Yeah, and there will be times, I'm sure there will be times where you may need to get to that level of of debugging, right? Yep, got to look at my query, my function, what's going on with that, right? Yep. Okay, cool.
And the final thing here, in terms of login, we didn't have time to look at that. But in terms of login, when you analyze your executor logs and kind of Spark driver logs, sometimes it becomes hard in the distributed system when all of the logs kind of happen at some point in time, and you need to recover like which things happen in which kind of task execution timeline. So what's helping here is adding this kind of additional keys, like a thread ID into your log, so you can chain kind of events within the same thread together. So this is log4j kind of configuration file modifications that you can perform to kind of get your kind of, this is basically a common problems with log debugging that.
Log4j is kind of a popular debugging tool or login tool. Awesome. Okay. All right. It's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So I think, you know, last episode on this, unless we want to come back and do really, really deep stuff. But anyway, we look forward to having you back. Thanks for coming. This is very helpful. Hopefully it was helpful for, to you. But we certainly look forward to having Maxim back and talking more big data stuff.
Yeah, so, thank you, Scott, for having me.
My pleasure. So we'll definitely have him back. We've got a couple topics we've been talking about. Those are a secret, but you'll see them shortly. So thanks for watching, everybody. We'll see you next time.